Over the last few years, the customer engagement landscape has changed dramatically. Consumers are bombarded by social media ads, sponsored content, and it's becoming increasingly difficult for brands to cut through the noise. Brands are even changing the way they approach Super Bowl ads, with some of the traditional players even eschewing them altogether. Super Bowl ads have long been the gold standard, the most expensive way to cut through, but I wanted to dive into customer engagement overall and see if there's an opportunity to shift to analog engagement in this digital world. Are people interested more in receiving a piece of mail, a physical giveaway? How does this work in a post-COVID world where people aren't going into stores, into movie theaters quite as much as traditional? So I have my good friend Brett Carney, client partner at Fuji, on the show to discuss and see if Crow knows customer engagement. You feel alive, let's hit the dance floor. Don't work too hard, my break a backbone. Return of the Mac, the king is back though. Corvette and cash, I never lack those. Shimmy, shimmy, yeah, I got the semi-fold weight. Don't step out the line like this a probate. You hit the line and try to locate. This for the time, got time for no day war. Welcome to another episode of the Crow Knows podcast. We are talking physical and digital branding and partnerships. I'm joined by my good friend, longtime friend, Brett Carney, who is a client partner at Fuji. Brett, thanks for coming on the show.
Man, thanks for having me. I'm excited to talk. You have to cut me off if I talk too much about myself, but this is cool.
It's all good. Speaking of that, I always love at the beginning here, give the listeners a little bit of an idea of who you are, what you do, ultimately why you're qualified to talk on this subject, which I know you are. So give us a little bit of a background on you and Fuji and what you guys do.
Yeah. So Fuji is a company that works with a lot of the biggest brands in the country. So, you know, the week after the Super Bowl and looking at Super Bowl commercials, those are the brands that we help and work with often. So our company is relatively small, but we have this niche fit for a lot of the biggest brands, and that we're able to connect an action on social media with the delivery of an experience, a custom kit, really anything kind of runs the gamut. So we have some technology that bridges the digital social world with the in real life world. So brands use it as a way to engage, reward, surprise their fans, to try to build loyalty, to try to create buzz on social media. So it's been a really cool last 6 years for me with this company that, you know, I don't know when you cease being a startup, but we've been a small company that's you know, been on the rise, and to be able to learn on kind of front lines when you're in there from very early days has been cool for me, for someone who made a pretty drastic career shift in my 30s. And now it's been fun to be able to see kind of the changing landscape of marketing, advertising, and how these brands that so many of us are fans of continue to kind of push the envelope. So, you know, I'm sure we'll get into that in, you know, more specifics, but that's what it's like for me. So it's exciting. And this time right after the Super Bowl, it's cool because a lot of when you're watching the game on Sunday, you see the finished product of maybe like RFPs that hit our desk 6-10 months ago, where you didn't really know what they were thinking. You just knew the basic creative, or you knew that the product they were pushing, or the new message they were going for their brand. And then you see it play out with a $7 million commercial. It's kind of cool.
Or in Kanye's case, absolutely no partnership or support at all, and just an iPhone, iPhone and a dream.
Look, you could almost throw RFK Jr. in that boat too, but I won't, because that slides into a whole nother podcast territory.
Yeah, I wanted to have you on. You mentioned the Super Bowl because this is, everybody knows the commercials are obviously a huge part. We know it's $7 million for a spot. I think a lot of us wonder that. Don't understand how this works. Like, how do you possibly get an ROI on that? I think a lot of times we look at like some of these commercials, I'm like, all right, great. Now what? So what is the thinking behind these Super Bowl commercials? Why are brands so keen to invest this much? What do we miss? What do we not understand as average Joes watching these commercials?
I think you probably speak to more of like an existential question to advertising and marketing in general, which is how do you measure ROI? Perhaps that's the dirty little secret for that entire industry, is it's always going to be difficult, because there's the there's obviously the hard numbers, and the hard numbers associated with the Super Bowl are compelling. I think what do they say? Like, it's the it was the most watched television program ever, this particular Super Bowl. Yeah. And then you go, plus you have this Taylor Swift thing where marketers can say, hey, we're not only are we getting this massive audience of football fans, but we're getting this new audience of Taylor Swift fans that we're also watching. So I'm certain that they can, as they're putting together their recaps and presenting in boardrooms around the country this week, I'm sure they can point to it and say, it's a fairly significant ROI just playing off of those numbers. But still, $7 million for 30 seconds is tough, especially when you consider that virality and organic media, you have that chance every day to blow up and to do it at essentially no cost. So it is difficult. Like, it's the ultimate legacy big media play. Comes with a massive price tag, but then there's so many other ways to reach eyeballs now. So yeah, it would be tricky. I mean, I think that's part of the job for the executives, is to justify their own worth. But I guess if you look at it now, as far as how it's different, it does seem like those who do it best have learned that while it is 30 seconds on Sunday evening during the game, there's the whole on-ramp of what you're doing on the internet and on social in the days and weeks that lead up to it. And then obviously they hope there's that long tail of what you get after it. And I think you see, you know, like, you know, the Michael Cera partnership, where they kind of, I think they were the big winners in the before the game thing, where they had people talking about this spot, and then the spot shows up. You see with the Duncan guys, and they've got a million celebrities. Okay, a lot of people used a lot of celebrities, but they're getting traction now with the behind the scenes footage of Ben Affleck and Matt Damon throwing footballs with Tom Brady. So I think some of that stuff probably is more calculated than perhaps the average viewer realizes. I mean, you can remember in the last 10 years, it was like, oh my gosh, I can't believe they're releasing these commercials on the internet, on YouTube, on social ahead of the big day. It was like, you're spoiling your own thing. Now we take that for granted, and it's all part of this longer lead up that, sure, the high point is the Super Bowl commercial. But I would say for the investment, you better be getting a lot more out of it before and after.
I'm glad you said that, because I was very confused when I saw the Super Bowl spot on YouTube or X or Instagram. I thought, oh, okay, it's probably just like a teaser or something like that for what it's going to be, or it's different content. But then somebody are just putting the actual commercial on there. And I'm confused by that, if that's a, hey, we just want to get, you know, maybe not everybody's going to be watching, or we just want to generate buzz to watch it again. Or is it people sometimes just miss those spots online? Like, what is that? Why are people doing that? It's confusing.
I think so too. And I'm only giving it my best guess here, but perhaps it's acknowledging just how vital the internet and social media is to basic consumption. And rather than pretending that isn't true, making that part of the overall experience, and the spoiler alert in then doesn't really exist. One thing that I think is interesting, and you may be better versed in this one than me, because movies are kind of a weak spot for me, but a focus of this podcast. It was interesting, like, there are a bunch of trailers for movies, which I guess is always true, but it's good to kind of see it really back post-pandemic. But several of the trailers, and when I said trailers that ran during the Super Bowl as commercials, several of them are actually pointing to, hey, go watch our full trailer online. So it's almost like the Super Bowl commercial is a commercial for the movie trailer that's posted for free on YouTube, which, when you think about it, it's kind of mind blowing. But again, I guess in terms of engagement and understanding how these consumers actually are behaving, it's such a different path than what it used to be.
The other thing that you mentioned, which was what I was going to ask you about, you mentioned the executives, like, how much of this is just kind of like the billionaire thing with sports teams? It's like, you know, sometimes they just want to say, hey, we've got a Super Bowl spot.
I think probably most of it, quite frankly. Like, I do think there's something, because of where the Super Bowl commercials rank just in culture, that that it does have some value, but I'm sure it's a part of making an announcement that you're a major brand. There's, you know, you are on the list of people who ran a Super Bowl commercial. Yeah, I'm sure there's some business cases where there are brands who have a number and they're not going to exceed that spend, and it's thought out. I mean, I think I read there were a couple brands this year that put out publicly that they weren't going to advertise in the Super Bowl, and then a week before changed their mind, which one would assume that has to be a pricing situation. But I think in most cases, it's like you spend the money to kind of say you did it, and you are now a brand that advertises during the Super Bowl. And it's also tough because for brands that have always advertised in the Super Bowl, some of the car manufacturers, some of the beer brands, where it's like now you have to almost pay the piper every year, or you have to get out in front of it as to why you're not choosing to do it, which is a tough spot.
It's a lot of keeping up with the Joneses kind of thing. And then it's just, hey, we just know that we're going to have this relatively escalating cost annually that we're just going to. But I think people get hooked on the $7 million price tag. Like, there's also significant costs in producing, developing the commercials themselves that have to be maybe not at that cost, but it's got to be pretty significant.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's the first part I think about too. And especially now where the trend, obviously, if you're watching the commercials, is like celebrity cameos all over the place. And those, the cost to get those folks to agree to do that, has to be right up there with buying the time from CBS. And that's just one person's opinion. And I want to say, like, when I watch the Super Bowl, I am first and foremost a fan of the football. I'm there to watch football, and I observe the ad spots as a fan as well, but perhaps not with as keen an eye, but as some people who work more directly in advertising. But to me, I just don't know that I connect with the celebrity cameo thing, because the wow factor to me just isn't there. You know, again, if you go back to 10, 15 years ago, there was this thought of, I can't believe they got that person to appear in a commercial. And that was the hook. Well, now it's like, I mean, Verizon got Beyonce. That's like one of the top, I don't know, 5 stars in the whole world. And you're just like, okay, I get it. Because I mean, we get celebrities in commercials now 52 weeks a year. Maybe not Beyonce, but I mean, Taylor Swift is doing Capital One commercials that you'll see all through March Madness. So it's not, I don't know, the just like the shock value of the celebrity to me isn't what it used to be. And yet you see that as like the main device in a lot of these commercials. The commercials that resonated with me the most were actually the ones that didn't go that route. So yeah, kind of interesting. Again, you're right. People talk about 7 million, I guess, because it's a number that is publicly available, but I would love to know, I mean, what you're paying 2-3 bona fide A-list celebrities to appear in the same commercial has to be right there with it.
Yeah, because it seems like unless you have a Beyonce, which obviously for hers, she was using that as a tool to announce the new album. And so that makes sense as a way to get that conversation going. But the rest of it seems like you have to have multiple celebrities in there. And we know they're not doing it for free. But you're right that everybody's doing commercials now. It used to be, I think it was like Jerry Seinfeld doing the American Express commercial was a big deal. It used to be kind of frowned upon, and that was a money grab. But now everyone's getting paid so much that it's the novelty's worn off. I don't need another outlet to see a celebrity. If I want to see a celebrity, I'm constantly inundated on Instagram or X or people that use TikTok and everything like that. So I don't know. I don't know how we continue this arms race of just going bigger and bigger and bigger, because inevitably it's going to reach a breaking point where companies are going to look at this and just say, hey, I'm just not interested. Or is it, hey, we just get back to like actually making good commercials that are good messages and good pieces of, of television.
Well, yeah, you make 2 points that I think are interesting. First one is, I hadn't thought about the celebrity piece that we already know these guys. Like the idea of, oh my God, I've never seen Jerry Seinfeld when he's not in his apartment or on the stand-up stage, and now he's on American Express, was interesting. But now we know so much more about these celebrities because they're managing their brands on social media that it becomes less interesting. Not to mention the idea of selling out. It's been proven that that's like a concept that doesn't even exist anymore. And by that, I mean like generations younger than us don't even selling out isn't a thing. So that idea of, wow, I can't believe they got Seinfeld to do that. It's like, okay, not like Christopher Walken doing a BMW commercial doesn't even strike me as odd. And to your point about, do we just get back to more like normal meat and potatoes commercials? I mean, my three favorites were kind of out of that vein because they stopped me and I actually thought about the product and I thought about the messaging in no particular order. I thought the Poppy essentially product launch, which was that healthier for you soda alternative, was interesting.
Big in our household.
Yeah, well, see, I didn't know it. So it was like the only commercial that made me pick up my phone and Google, like, what is this product? That seems effective. It's been a little divisive on social media and in the press in the days that follow about, I don't know, the messaging, but I guess that's part of it. I also saw that they're reporting yesterday that Coke is kicking the tires on an acquisition. So it's working for them, right? The second one was the Dove commercial about like young girls playing sports and the drop-off rate as they get older and tying that into self-image and body insecurity and those messages. I guess it's probably me as a father of a girl, as I know you are too, it just kind of struck me. It was one of those like made you stop and think. And then the third one was Snapchat, which I just thought it was a cool message about social media, almost like in its more pure form, like use us not to follow influencers, use us not to follow brands, use us to connect with your actual friends. I just thought, what a different message. It's always risky when you're kind of like demarketing against your industry.
Yeah.
But all three of those kind of stopped me in my tracks. But again, I think there's something to say where like those almost are like, I don't want to say negative, but they're not as cheerful. None of them had humor. Yeah. And I know a lot of times with marketing and advertising, it's this counterbalance of what's going on in culture versus the message. So right now, you know, the political election stuff, doesn't everyone feeling great? There's the turmoil in the Middle East. There's just kind of a general unease. And so I think that's why you saw a lot of the marketing be like, let's go big, let's go very surface level, let's try to make you laugh, let's just throw some celebrities at it, versus like, we're not going to tug on the heartstrings. Usually the like Clydesdales, like hugging puppies commercials happen when things are a little bit more fruitful in general for society. So
that's a really good point. I also wanted to go back to the celebrity piece because I've been looking for an avenue to talk about this, and this is a perfect one. And you're a good person to talk about it with. And I think that concept of selling out, which is really interesting because I think we're so inundated now with ads in a lot of ways. And I think podcast overall, like it's funny watching the evolution, or I guess listening to the evolution of the podcast ad reads. When you hear people, you know, my favorite is you got someone doing the ad read for Vrbo or for Airbnb talking about, you know, how crappy hotels are. And then a month later, all of a sudden it's an ad read for Hilton. And they're talking about how crappy the Airbnb and Vrbo experience is and all the fees and stuff. And so I think everybody just at this point realizes it's just a cash grab. You take the money, get in where you fit in kind of thing.
Yeah, I think there's no Defiant L's Twitter account for, changing loyalties in who you market with and who's advertising with you. Because you're right. I think it has been bore out that like the younger generation, which using that term makes me sound so old, but Gen Z and beyond, they just don't equate selling out. I mean, I remember speaking of Super Bowl commercials, being a kid 25 years ago in The Who, the 70s rock band who my dad was obsessed with, puts their song just as like the backing track in, car commercial. And or maybe it was Led Zeppelin, I don't remember, but my dad is just like crushed, like, oh my gosh, how could they sell out? It's a class. And now it's like, I mean, you wouldn't think anything of it. I mean, now that's like your way to get new music out. So yeah, the lines between what's paid, what's sponsored content, they really don't exist to most people.
Yeah. Let's shift gears a little bit towards the topic that I really want to hit on, because it's really interesting. And I remember when we talked a couple years ago about what you guys do, it's always stuck in my head because it's really cool and it's really different, but it's this blending of digital and physical in terms of outreach campaigns to reach clients. And a big part of what I like talking to people about, and I think what a lot of people find value in this show is going across industries and figuring out what are people doing differently and how are people reaching clients and engaging them. Because ultimately, that's the name of the game for every business, right? How do we get in front of our clients and create lasting loyalty for people? And you guys do it in a really interesting way. And you talked about it a little bit off the top. I've noticed myself becoming increasingly excited when I get mail and going to the mailbox and actually holding physical mail, which it may just be that I'm getting to a point that I didn't really ever want to get to as an adult, but I'm excited about that. And that's something I think that is probably part of what you guys do and how you guys think about that. So give us a little bit more on how you guys really, how you came up with this idea and also how people have, from what you guys have looked at, what people really like about receiving the physical part of the equation.
Yeah. And you know what? There's even something as simple as direct mail, which essentially means like a flyer that shows up to dear resident. That's not what we do, but there's pretty good proof that even those things effectiveness are actually on the increase, which probably speaks to, again, just the idea of mail. Plus it's a less cluttered environment because no one's getting actual mail anymore. So it's a nice touch point versus like in your inbox. But
it used to be the opposite, where everyone was inundated with mail. And so everybody said, all right, well, forget mail because it's just going to all get thrown in the trash at the same time. But it does seem like now everybody's kind of, because we have so much digital, everybody's kind of yearning for the analog.
Yes, that's exactly right. And there's probably a bunch of examples beyond what we do, but that is kind of the basic tenet, I suppose, that we're using. And so what we've tried to do is take that same idea, build out technology and logistics, and logistics is inherently boring to talk about, but you got to have it to be able to do this stuff. So can you marry technology and logistics in a way where you can take this feeling of delivering something physical and all of the emotion that comes with receiving it, with opening it? And can you do that in such a way, you being a business, you being a brand, that does it to scale? Because I think every brand, from the very largest to the smaller ones, from B2B to B2C, understands what we're describing. But I think if you don't have a way to do it at scale, it's hard to make the case for it. So that's kind of what we try to help brands do, whether it's surprise and delight, which means you see your best voices on social media saying, I love this brand. Can you get them something? Well, it's probably, you should as a marketer, but do you really want to walk to the closet, find a gift, put it in a box? Now you have to go get that user's information. Is it secure how you receive the information? Then you have to walk it down to the mailroom or to UPS and get it there. So I think the challenge for a lot of these companies is to be able to do something in a way that is high touch and will grow loyalty and get you a fan for life, because everyone understands the value of that, but be able to do it in such a way where you didn't spend 45 minutes helping one person. So our technology just connects that action on social, so we can see who's talking about a brand, and then they can start a conversation between the brand and the user. It's our tech that's kind of just the pipes that manage that conversation. The data flows where the user says, yep, I'm Brent Carney, I live at 123 Main Street. And then it's logistics to get the stuff sourced and get it delivered. And I think that's what gets interesting is, obviously, I'm not comparing us to Amazon by any means, but that's, again, what works for Amazon is they have this great platform, but then they have the logistics and the functionality to get you the stuff where you need to get it. So for us, it was guys who built technology that they just thought would be an interesting thing on social media that could connect a social media action with a DoorDash delivery. That was how this began. And it was just crossing wires on open API systems and just kind of building computer engineering stuff into this has to be stood up with actual logistics. So now we're talking warehousing, pick and packing, shipping. It's an interesting world to link those two things, but I think it is so important to understand there's still a space, and perhaps more so now than ever before, for the actual in real life experience. And I would hope to think, because if not, God bless us for humanity. But I would hope to think that even as we get into this AI world and, you know, the metaverse and all these things, that there, that that's only going to increase more, that to see something, to touch something, to have it delivered to you, that feeling of personalization is going to be really difficult to fake.
Yeah. I think part of, you know, think about what I wanted to hit on and get your perspective on today. I a lot of times come back to movies as a big driver of, you know, we mentioned the trailers in the Super Bowl, but I think is a big driver of a lot of business overall, especially when it comes to marketing and customer engagement, because, you know, a successful movie not only wants to do well at the box office, but they really want to create lifetime customers. And obviously that box office experience has dwindled pretty significantly, not only just people going to movies, but also just the general landscape of the industry. A lot of people are just going straight to streaming over the last couple of years. You got the big streamers that have just gobbled everything up, and it's not the same traditional kind of old school late 90s, you know, mid to late 90s kind of independent movie, create the big campaign, you know, get outreach direct to consumers, things like that. Everything's just funneled through digital. But how have you guys seen, and it doesn't have to just be the movie industry, but how have you guys seen that landscape change over the last 3 or 4 years?
Yeah, I mean, I think the experience is around, let's say it's a movie, is everything. So where you're getting a lot of that then is not in the movie theater, but maybe they have to take their dollars and create some sort of experiential world at South by Southwest, or take over a ghost kitchen in New York City. So they understand that people do want experiences, even if they're watching the movie at home. So it used to be your experience was going to the theater and doing everything that came with it. But now it might be that they have to create something outside of the theater experience that doesn't necessarily show the movie, but just drives home the brand and builds the fandom that way. And then, you know, for us, it's kind of taking, again, an experience on a smaller level, but be able to deliver it to more households. So we're doing a ton of, hey, it's release day for the latest Trolls movie. Well, that's a family movie. So families aren't going to the theater, but they're going to have a movie night at home. So let's put together 2,000 kits that have a build your own trail mix set. You tweet or post a picture on Instagram of your family. You tag us. That enters you for a chance to win this kit. It shows up. Now you've got an activity that you can do around movie night, and everything is branded with Trolls branding. And hey, there's a coupon inside for 20% off of Vudu to purchase the movie, because that's actually owned by an NBCU, just like Universal Pictures is. And so, you know, again, it's challenging all these brand people to just think differently. But that's post pandemic. That's digital and social ramping up. So again, different ways to do it. It's just difficult for sometimes marketers, I think, to justify the expense related to these things when it used to be a lot easier, and they didn't necessarily have to sink their dollars into reaching fans in new ways.
Yeah, because there was built in. I mean, if you go into the movies, if you look at all the physical aspect of outreach and capturing people, you had a lot of physical touch points, whether it be the movie theater itself, the video store, which obviously is a thing of the past. There was all these different actual in-person physical experiences where the customer was not trapped, but at least captive, that you could capitalize on and sell more merch, right? You put to use your Trolls example, put the Troll dolls on the end cap on the video store and or at the register, and boom, you've got that. And I know there's still a component of that at some of the different grocery stores, convenience stores, things like that, but it's just not quite the same as that built-in audience that was going specifically for a movie that you knew was going to be interesting.
And it even goes, that was kind of like the first iteration. You think about even since then, you go, what is advertising and social and digital look like? Because it used to be that you could just dump a bunch of money into Google AdWords or a Facebook paid or a Twitter boosted post or buy the trend for the day. And that would more than suffice. But now, as you know, as we all kind of grow into social media as truly second nature, the expectation from all of these brands, they have to do more than just be a megaphone that's shouting their message. It has to be this two-way street. That's what consumers expect. So if I'm telling you that Trolls was awesome and I'm tagging you, the expectation is that you're going to comment back to me and say, thanks for watching. It's not enough for this, for it just to be blasting messaging that, hey, tonight's opening day, to see this video. So, but it's tough because, so you're almost valuing performance marketing, right? Like with those social media, it's like you pay this much money and you're going to get this range of engagements and impressions. And it's very transactional. Well, now if the expectation is to go beyond that, again, to get back to the measuring ROI, like, how do you measure that? And how do you, the marketer, justify the value of an engagement as it's defined on Twitter or as it's defined on Facebook, which is I clicked this or I commented about it, versus a real life engagement, which is I got something, it made me feel special, and now I'm likely a fan for life. So having to compare those two things, and again, as social behavior changes on the consumer side and what they expect from brands that they like, yeah, it's tricky. And again, so can your dollars go as far? Can you justify a spend that's a little bit softer in the results than, again, tracking people through the doors at the movie theater or people who engage with your paid post? So that's what these guys have got to figure out.
All these different opportunities that people have and everyone looking for cutting through the noise. And the one thing that is not confusing for anybody is getting a physical item and looking at it. Because I think about just continuing with TV and movies, that now it's not only enough to put your movie or TV show out on streaming, but then you're also relying on people now to figure out where it is. And for some people, it's super easy. But for people that may not know, you know, you've got to go through four different streaming services to figure out where that movie is. And now we're seeing re-releases in theaters from some of those that didn't get a chance to do a lot of this stuff, you know, in 2020 and even 2021. But do you guys get a sense that there's almost a sense of security from brands with this concept of physical, that at least, if nothing else, we know there was a physical product that people were receiving and interacting with versus just the generic digital, you know, hey, dollars go out and we can measure an ROI on the back end?
Yes, I think the brands that are willing to do it know that. And I think it's even, you know, it bore out one in basic human nature, I think. I mean, you described it, like the feeling of receiving something is something that every person can relate to. So if you can cast that feeling wider, that's, you know, that's a good thing. But you know, there's other evidence of it. I mean, they'll see, you know, UGC, user generated content, where people will get back online and share it. And I mean, think about how crazy it is where, like, there is a unboxing, like that's a term, you know. Yeah. so even for, yeah, that term to exist tells you that, like, this is something we took for granted because we're old enough to receive something in person, now is like an event because it just doesn't happen that much. So, yeah, I mean, I think brands see the value in that, and especially when they can tie it in and use the creative of what's being delivered to match it with the plot line of the movie. And you know, is it, a lot of times, I think the coolest ones are like those, if you know, you know, sort of moments where what you deliver really hits the hardcore fans and they're like, oh my gosh, like, what a personalized, cool experience. That, you know, it's not just like, hey, here's a bag of popcorn so it can, your home can feel like the movie theater, but it's actually like something that nods to something in the series or something that fans of the IP would know. That can be really, really cool. And then you have a chance, if you do it that correct, that, you know, now you can get earned media, now you can get people writing about it and there's buzz. And that's kind of, you know, the big goal on a lot of these.
That's, you mentioned the experience piece, which I think is really what ultimately we're getting at, which is what most brands are trying to figure out in this, you know, in this different world that we have, specifically movies and TVs. Like, so much of it is the event and how you feel doing it. We know any kind of art, whether it be, you know, music, television, movies, it's more about how you feel when consuming it than it is the actual content itself. And so it's such an interesting value that you guys bring to be able to create more of an experience around something that you may be streaming at home for whatever reason, and it very well could just be, hey, all of a sudden, if you're taking a family of four to the movies and getting popcorn, drinks, tickets, everything, all of a sudden you're in for $100+ and you're still not 100% sure that it's going to be good. And so a lot of people are just staying home for that reason. And so it's hard for people to connect in the same way versus, hey, I went to the theater, experienced it with a group of people around us, that just makes this stuff so much better.
Yeah, I mean, I think the tricky part is to just make it worth it, because obviously the things we're talking about have hard costs, not only mailing, but the stuff you put in the delivery, and all of that gets expensive. So then I think that the onus on the brand is you better know your audience, and you better know exactly who you're trying to reach. And you better make sure if you're sending these things out that you're getting them to the people that you want. And that's what I think a lot of these brands are figuring out, is really trying to be able to put up a fence around their audience. And that can look like a lot of different types of people, and can be found a lot of different places. But if you can figure that out, if you can figure out your data, if you can keep in contact with those people who mean the most to you, then this can be incredibly useful. But it puts the pressure on you to make sure you know that about your fan base, probably more so than ever before.
This has been super interesting. I could talk about this stuff all day long, and the behind the scenes of how this stuff really works, and what the thought process is that goes into it. Want to finish up with our final segment, as always, our Mount Rushmore segment. And obviously, I know you're a huge football fan, and we probably may share a couple similar answers on here. But for your Mount Rushmore, I want to hear, coming off the Super Bowl, obviously talk of a Chiefs dynasty, a lot of comparisons to the Patriots. Give me your Mount Rushmore on best football teams of all time.
We talked about this question before we recorded, and you told me you're going to ask. We haven't reviewed answers. And it got me thinking, as both a football and basketball fan, which we both are, it's interesting how, when you look at the NFL, how like neatly packaged this answer is, and how like it's just not debated like basketball is. I don't know if basketball is just like more debatable because there's only five guys, and so it's easy to be like, this guy's gonna guard that guy, and football is more nuanced, so it's hard to do it. But you look through like history of the NFL and our teams, it's like, okay, right now Chiefs, before that Patriots, okay, that's the 2000s. Now we're in the 90s, the Cowboys. You bump down to the 80s, 49ers. You bump down to the 70s, late 70s Steelers, early 70s Dolphins, and now we're at the beginning of the Super Bowl. It's like, what I think would be an interesting debate, although it's not what I'm going to have right now because I would need time, is like, what about the one-off teams that won the Super Bowl? Because there are some good one-off teams in there. Like, the only one anyone ever talks about is, I feel like the only one that history remembers is like the, what is it, 85 Bears? You hear that. But like, you know, the Rams of 3-4 years ago, pretty good team. But they'll never be remembered because it's like, in football, you have to win multiples for us even to remember you. One Super Bowl, even if you had an incredible offense and a dominant defense, no one's ever going to be like, was that the best football team that ever played? You know, so anyways, that is a long aside. But therefore, I think my answer is relatively simple, which is 2000s Patriots. If I can take like a 20-year span, I'm putting them as like number one gold standard in my life. Then I go 70s Steelers. I do not like the Steelers. Their fans annoy me. However, like when you just look at how many Hall of Famers they had, now granted, that's pre-salary cap. So it was a little bit easier or pre-free agency, I should say. So that's a little easier to keep your team together. And then I go 90s Cowboys for nostalgia, because I was right in my childhood. And then current iteration Chiefs. But current iteration Chiefs could be moving up the list. But those would be my 1-4.
It's a funny thing that, again, you don't see that really talked about in basketball either, for the one-off teams. Yeah, the dynasties, you know, most of the championships were won by the Lakers and Celtics pretty much, and then now Warriors.
And don't you have to think like those teams that were able to win within the dynasty years, like, again, I'm not petitioning that the Rams of a couple of years ago are the best football team ever, but like they won a championship at the height of the Chiefs' powers. What about Brady's Bucks? I mean, they beat Mahomes at the height of the Chiefs' powers by 3 touchdowns. So do we put them in there?
I
don't know. But it's almost like you really can't get entered into the historical conversation, seems like, unless you get a couple of these.
And even that's not necessarily enough. Like the Giants beat Brady twice. It's insane. And everybody just kind of chalks it up as like, yeah, I know it happened, but
Yeah, like that.
And they beat probably the best team of all time in that undefeated Patriots team.
Right. So where does that leave you if you're the Giants? Right.
Yeah. I have no idea. I don't think there's ever been a historical comparison for that. It's still something, again, I forget about pretty regularly that they did it twice.
You know, if my analytics people would stop telling me like the thing you should have done on like 4th and 3 from the 43, I would be much more interested in like, yeah, how these teams actually find some sort of through line to compare those teams would be interesting. But that seems like it's only done in baseball. Baseball fans love to compare generations. So I don't know.
Yeah. I don't, it's a hard question, but I'm definitely much more interested in this, to your point, than whether or not Shanahan should have taken the ball first or second. That somehow everybody's got thoughts on and a thing that doesn't make any sense has been proven to really not make a difference. And yet everybody's got real strong thoughts on that, but not the blocked extra point, several fumbles. I think that's the Mount Rushmore of sports debates probably should have been the topic here. And arguing the day after on the decision that really didn't have any impact on the game, I think probably is up there.
Yeah, that's the real with, problem with Mount Rushmore. I know. So you pull that one back out with someone else on this thing. There's a debate.
Yeah. Well, we'll definitely have you back on as a regular for talking through some of these branding campaigns and ideas and things like that. This has been incredible. Give us some plugs. Where can we find you? Where can the audience find you guys? You specifically, yeah. Fuji. How do we?
I keep a pretty low profile on social these days, but at Brent Carney. But follow Fuji. It's at GoFuji Instagram, Twitter.
FOOJI.
Thank you. FOOJI. And if for nothing else, you can have a chance to win some of the cool stuff we've been talking about. But really good way to engage with brands and do something on social media that hopefully doesn't feel soul sucking and brings a little authentic joy and happiness to those platforms. And I appreciate you as we wrap it up. I do appreciate you having me on here and let me talk, and I'm excited about this show, and I've enjoyed the first few episodes, and big things to come. So anytime I can come on, I'm happy to do it, but I will certainly be listening.
Awesome. Thanks a lot, man. Well, I appreciate you coming on. I look forward to having you back. And again, everybody, Brent Carney, client partner at Fuji, check them out. A lot of incredible stuff that they're doing there. And Brent, appreciate you coming on. Talk soon.